This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Over the past week, I've been, I was curious about Guangzhou as a place. I've never been to China. Much that I read seems to rhyme with Guangzhou today, which is, you know, it's the third largest city in China, I think. It's more than 13 million citizens. And then the Pearl River Delta megacity, of which it's a part, is this vast region with over 44 million people. And it's a very old city. It's an ancient city. And I read a couple of things that really surprised me. It's been a trading city since at least the first century BC. And in the 9th century, there were tons of foreigners there, living there, for their trade. And, you know, Arab Muslims, Jews, Persians, some Christians too, apparently. And so this history of the city as a crossroads seems to go way back. And yet this place that you photographed is rather novel. The bridge, anyway, is kind of a new structure. So I'm wondering if you can talk about whether the history of the city was important to you when you were thinking about the project, and does it show up? Does that history show up anywhere in the work?
First of all, thank you so much for coming, and Robert, both of you, and everybody else for being here on this cold night. I think when I first started, what really drew me in the beginning was not so much the history of the city. That wasn't really what I was thinking about. I was more thinking about, I had been interested in in what China was doing in Africa for a long time. So when I came to Guangzhou, I was just looking at the city, kind of just photographing the landscape, and then I came across this one neighborhood where there were a lot of Africans. So I guess I was sort of just struck by how all these people were there, and then kind of as I got to know the neighborhood better, then I started to see that there were many layers of foreigners there. There were Muslims and people from other parts of China. So I don't think it wasn't my initial intention to look at the layers of the city. It was just kind of my initial intention was more about the Africans that were there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And some of the photographs are off the bridge, though, right? And they're in the neighborhood. And even if the buildings are old, you get a sense of a really dense, old
right.
place, you know.
Yeah, I mean the neighborhood surrounding, like it's actually the oldest part of Guangzhou, and it feels a bit like as I got to know it, it became more and more rich as I kind of explored it. It's a little bit like 52nd Street in West Philadelphia, or maybe like Roosevelt Avenue in Queens. It's this neighborhood where many different cultures kind of come together. And I think as I was photographing, that became more and more what drew me, just the kind of layers of complexity. It's almost like this palimpsest of different people that were passing through this one area. And much of Guangzhou is actually very new. Like whole swaths of the city have been torn down, and they've built kind of these new opera houses and kind of a whole new downtowns, and in a way, this is the one area that feels like there is a continuity with the past of Guangzhou. So I think that's ultimately what kind of kept me going back, the sense of wanting to see what just kind of these layers of history there.
Yeah. I liked in reading your discussions about the project. I think you described the bridge at one point, the footbridge, as a place to take a break or like get a respite from the density of the city.
Right, right. Yeah, the bridge, because there's all these like incredibly intricate laneways, and most of the whole neighborhood is people are there to trade and to there's Muslims, there's people from South Asia. The whole area is a place where people come to do business and to buy the products that are produced in the Pearl River Delta. So there's a sense of kind of like commercial energy everywhere. It's kind of everybody's kind of on the make, and you can't really escape that. You know, in these lanes, there's shopping malls where people are kind of buying all sorts of things. So my feeling was whenever I came up onto this pedestrian bridge, there's a sense of kind of taking a break from all this intense energy. It felt all of a sudden you're in this very open space where you can see into the distance, and I don't know, somehow there's a psychological kind of rest from all the craziness around there. So, and I think I just out of needing a break from what was around there, I ended up photographing there quite a bit, and I think for the same reasons the other people were drawn there just to kind of get away from everything else that was there, and they were just kind of it was almost like a public space where people would go to kind of look out into the landscape and smoke and hang out with friends.
Yeah, I mean that's what's very intriguing to me about the bridge in your photographs is that it seems like a public space that kind of took shape organically, right? It's not that a designer sort of created it. It was built for functional purposes,
right.
And I guess it goes over the ring road. Is that right?
Yeah, it goes over a peripheral road, one of the ring roads, and it actually connects. There's sort of two different neighborhoods. One is a more commercial neighborhood. Another one is kind of like a little village within the area. So people are constantly using this bridge as a means of transportation. But it's also become this market and this place where people just go to hang out and sit around.
So Robert, as somebody who's deeply involved in the production of Daniel's book, what drew you to this work?
What brought me to?
Yeah.
Well, a number of things. I mean, one, I've known Daniel for a few years. Before this project even came about, but one day we bumped into each other at a photography festival in Guangdong province, actually, and he told me about this encounter he had made with these two Chinese photographers, street photographers, who had set up their studio on a bridge, and I thought it was a very interesting situation, because my background, my interest was less in China than it was in Africa. That's where I sort of grew up. When I was a student, I was studying West African languages. I know Africa a little bit. And the minute he told me about this community in Guangzhou, I started to so that there was something there that mm-hmm. was quite interesting, because as Daniel indicated a little while ago, or often mentions, that we hear about China in Africa, you know, and especially in this country, you know, there's always this fear about China's there, it's a big threat, they're all over the place now, they're in Africa, they're building roads, they're doing things that we never did and we should have done, and maybe it would have been better if we had. But we didn't, and now they're coming there, so there's a bit of a threat at the same time, and there's a lot of discomfort. And even in Europe, in France in particular, I'm half French, half British, and living in New York. So I'm a triple colonialist. I know all about, and I understand these situations. But Africa, since I was a kid, is the place I always dreamt of. And Africa and China, because I had developed so much interest in China over the last 20 or so years, just made me want to follow this project, even from afar. Originally, it was just from afar. We were meeting, and we went on, and meeting every so often, and Daniel told me about the progress and developments. But I know in one of our discussions I was very concerned about how you would preserve this kind of work, because you have these photographers taking pictures. They're not doing it for the art. They're not saying that they're artists or they're documentarians. They're making a living, which is the case of most portrait painters and photographers throughout the history of humanity, sure, in the first place. So they were doing what everybody else had been doing many centuries before them. But then the question is, where does all that work go? Where, what happens to it, especially in this digital age? And we spoke about that a few times. And that's how Daniel, you know, convinced them to allow him to accumulate all these images on a hard drive so that it would be preserved. Maybe it's a matter of generation, I'm very concerned about preserving these fragments of history, of this human, that are part of our human landscape. So that's how I got involved in the project. And one day Daniel said to me, look, you have interest, why don't you help me to edit it? So that's how I got on board, really.
So Wu and Zhang are the two photographers, right? Who are kind of related to each other.
Right.
And there's kind of a soap opera attached to that, as I recall, which is a fun story. what do they make of your interest? I mean, you know, one of the things you wanted to talk about tonight is authorship. And, you know, the idea that perhaps the portrait subjects are more the authors of their portraits than these two photographers, which I think is a really interesting thing to think about. But what do they, you know, what have they made of your interest, and, you know, has their thinking evolved in interacting with you? They must be pleased that you want these pictures, I'm guessing.
Well, first let me just say that, you know, about the space itself, about the bridge, I think one reason why everything evolved or kind of happened on this bridge is what I was saying before, is that there is a sense that people feel quite differently. It's a public space, but I think because it's kind of a loft that it's you know, separated from the surrounding neighborhood, people kind of go there looking for something. And I think it's because of just the nature of the space that Wu and Zhang felt like this is the place to set up shop. You know, this is the place where this is where they would get business, for one thing. But somehow, it seemed to me like I felt that way. When you go onto this bridge, you're kind of transformed a little bit. You're in this more reflective state of mind, and maybe open to kind of looking at yourself, looking at, you know, thinking about your life, thinking about your kind of reflecting on your life. So it seemed like the appropriate place to set up this photo studio. So I was hanging out there, just taking my own pictures, and I saw Wu, this photographer who was about maybe early 30s when I first met him 6 years ago. And I just kind of stood behind and just was observing what he does. And so he would just kind of wangle up to, kind of sidle up to people, and in a very charming, you know, very subtle way, convince people to have their picture taken. So I sort of watched the process over a few hours, and then I went up to him and asked if I could look at some of the pictures, and immediately I found them compelling. And I wasn't really sure what it was at first, but I found that there's something very immediate and intimate about all the portraits that he was taking, and I guess they reminded me of African pictures, of pictures that I've seen of African portraiture. So I guess, long story short, I befriended Wu, and he eventually kind of, you know, became interested in why I was interested too, and we kind of developed a friendship. And I started to collect his pictures at first. Like, he would, he gave me a batch of pictures which I took back to New York.
You mean prints?
No, digital files.
Digital files.
And then I sort of thought about them for a while, and then I came back maybe 6 months later, and then that's where I met Zhang, the other photographer. And he wasn't there at first. Because Wu was so successful, his wife invited all her relatives from Hunan province. So the next time I came back, there were about five other photographers also working there.
All relatives of Wu's wife.
Yeah, all, I'm kind of losing track of your question, but I think basically in the long run, they kind of came to see their own work differently, I think, than they had originally. No, it was purely a way of them for them to make a living. They're migrant workers from Wu was from
Jiangxi. No.
Yeah, where was it?
Jiangxi.
Yeah. Zhen was from Hunan, and they came to Guangzhou just out of they're migrant workers, so they came just to see what they could do. They weren't making much money in their home province. They had families. Zhen had families to support, and Guangzhou is a big city. So, I mean, they're much like 200 million other migrant workers in China who come to the big cities, and they happen to find this way of making a living, taking photographs. I don't think they were thinking about, you know, I'm going to capture all this incredible movement of Africans coming into China. It just so happens that they were on this bridge where Africans were pouring into China, and they were taking these pictures. So it was really...
That's one of the reasons I love seeing your pictures with theirs, because their photographs they're all, you know, pictures of individual subjects, about individual subjectivity. and, you know, some of the portraits almost feel like tourist snapshots, like, oh, I'm, you know, here I am right now.
Well, that's what they are.
Right. but then your pictures are, if I'm thinking about subjectivity, they're really about historical subjectivity in a way, and groups of people as historical subjects. But your interest in archiving their work sort of brings those two impulses together, you know, and it's amazing. Now, do you feel that the subjects of the portraits were more involved in choosing their backgrounds, for instance, than the two photographers?
At first, my feeling was that I saw them more as self-portraits, because I guess I saw Wu and Zhen almost like they were sort of like machines. Mm-hmm. Like they were just sort of functionary. Like the subjects were kind of telling the photographers where they wanted to be photographed, and they were their presence was what was kind of enlivening the pictures. It seemed like they had a tradition of African photography in their mind, like Seydou Keita, Malik Sadebe, and the picture sort of reminded me of that. So I wasn't really thinking about so much about Wu and Zhen as individual photographers. And in fact, in earlier versions of the book that I was editing, I kind of mixed the two of their work together because I didn't really see so much of a difference. I mean, I was aware that, for instance, Wu was maybe less accomplished technically. Mm-hmm. Like his pictures were a little bit not as polished. Zhen was a little bit more, he had a fancy camera, he kind of got a little bit closer. But actually it wasn't until I started working with Robert that I started to think more about Wu and Zhen as individual photographers. Robert really caught on that they both had kind of like a different style, that Wu is a little bit shy. I mean, just in terms of their personality, Wu is a little bit shyer, a little bit more reserved, whereas Zhen is more kind of aggressive and more of a businessman in a way. Wu, another difference is Wu actually was saving his pictures. He was kind of sentimental about the pictures that he was making. Like he wanted to be able to, 20 years from now, look back at this period of his life and look at these pictures. Whereas Zhen would delete his memory cards at the end of each day, so he was just purely mercenary. Mm-hmm. So it was after starting to look at the work with Robert that we started to think about how to separate the two bodies of work and kind of bring out the differences in styles, and also just start to think about kind of the interplay between who is the author? Is it the person that's commissioning the picture, or is it the photographer? And I think it's a bit of both. Mm-hmm. And also me, because I'm I'm the one who's decided to collect these pictures.
And you've, in a sense, curated the ones that you thought were more interesting, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. And also, you know, Zinn's pictures wouldn't exist if I hadn't given them a hard drive.
Right. But there's, in Africa, there's a long tradition of being photographed.
Yes.
It goes back.
I was just in Bamako, and I got to go to Malik Sidibe's studio, and I even had my picture taken there. I was very excited. But what I learned is that, you know, in Bamako, the city where these two great portrait photographers were, that Daniel mentioned, Malik Sidibe and Seydou Keita, there weren't a lot of other outlets for visual art up until the 1990s. And so these studios were very important, and there are still photo studios all over the city. And they just happen to be really extraordinarily creative,
great practitioners. You know, they're born out of colonization, particularly in French-speaking Africa, where the French very quickly imposed ID cards, identification, meaning mugshots, and that created a lot of jobs. Also, there's been this tremendous Lebanese and Armenian influence in the whole of West Africa. These people who traveled and developed these studios, these studios all over West Africa, etc. So, when you were asking, you know, who made the picture? Is it the subject? Is it the photographer? In the case of Guangzhou, well, yes, it is both. It always is both, anyhow.
Well, any portrait
Annie Leibovitz is a great portrait photographer, would always tell you that she's, you know, thinking of the portrait and making the portrait, but the subject is absolutely, and that we know, and it's been a long time. But in Africa, it's very true, because there is a tradition of being photographed. So there is a sort of attitude and behavior one has before the camera, and I think many of these subjects of Wu and Zhang taught them how to develop their photography and develop their own style of photography. And that's why those styles do exist in this case. And they correspond to their own personalities, this more reserved and slightly detached attitude of Wu's and Zhang, who's, you can see, he's a wheeler dealer. He's trying and he interacts with the subject in a much more intense way. So they do have their own styles, and those styles are partially shaped by these subjects who are accustomed to being photographed and like being photographed, which is not necessarily the case everywhere else.
Right. You know, are there photo studios in Guangzhou?
Say?
I was asking Daniel, are there a lot of photos? Because, you know, in the States, the photo studio has, you know, gone the way of the dinosaur, right? I mean, even Sears, I don't think. Maybe you can still get your portrait there, but it just doesn't really, it's not a part of our culture the way it was 40 or 50 years ago.
Right. The wedding studios. Okay. I mean, most commercial photo practices are based
today
on weddings.
Today in China,
That's big business in China.
But Guangzhou has a long tradition of studios like Shanghai, like a few other cities, because of the French and the British who started those studios. And then the Chinese got involved and developed their own studios, and very successfully. Guangzhou and Shanghai were two really important centers from that point. We have some experts here who could answer better that question.
Well, and Daniel, not in this body of work, but in other bodies of work that you've made, you are a very sensitive portraitist. I mean, you've made beautiful portraits in North Philadelphia and in other parts of China, I believe, as well. Did you make any portraits in Guangzhou?
I did, actually. I mean, I actually did a body of work also on the bridge, which were portraits of... but it's complicated, because I actually started making some pictures that were not so different from what Wu and Zinn were doing, kind of like taking people and isolating them and photographing them. And then I met, but I wasn't really happy with them, and they didn't somehow work. And then I met Wu and Zinn, and I realized that they were kind of doing, what they were doing was much more interesting than what I was doing. And then I actually started to photograph kind of in response to the portraits that they were making. I started to kind of take pictures of people just as they were passing on the bridge, kind of people that were kind of more introspective and lost in their own thoughts. But I decided to not include them in this body of work because I felt that it kind of distracted from... I sort of decided to make their pictures the center of this body of work. Mm-hmm. And I found that including my own photographs diluted the project in a sense. So I
think your video, however, is sort of a beautiful portrait of the two of them.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's
and
true.
It's
yeah.
actually very sensitive.
Thank you.
That, you know, really, you know, really brings them, really made me engage with them as two characters, and even the personality differences that you talked about, Robert. As you watch the video, those come out, you know, and you see how they're acting, you know, interacting with the public.
Now, the video adds a tremendous dimension. I've seen them for the first time here tonight.
Okay.
I'm very impressed.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I'll say about, the whole archive of 25,000 pictures that I collected, you know, There are maybe 15% or so that are not of Africans. They're of Chinese, Middle Eastern people who also had their pictures taken on the bridge. And I thought of also at certain points including those. But one difference that I came across was that the Africans there's a very different presence that they have. They kind of have this kind of energy and gesture that seems to relate back to African portraiture that I didn't find in any of the other pictures, like of the Chinese. And I don't know if you found that too.
No.
But there was something. There was different reasons that we decided to focus, make the project only about the Africans. But that was one of them. I think in a way they were the most interesting. There was a kind of vitality and presence in the pictures that made it sort of obvious to focus on them.
Well, and it's true that Africa has had less of a relation with China than any other part of the world. I mean, historically speaking, it's really with the establishment of the People's Republic of China, because of the solidarity with third world countries, with countries fighting against imperialism, French, British, American, etc., that relationship developed with Africa. It was therefore very political, ideological. Very few Africans went to China in the 50s, 60s, 70s. They were students, there were some delegations, heads of states like Modibo Keita or Nkrumah, etc. They went there on official invitations. And you don't find in the history of Chinese photography representation of Africa, very, very little, because there were very few Africans who went there. In Li Jianchen's book on the Cultural Revolution, there is an amazing series of pictures he did himself with a delegation of young African journalists who had been invited to China, and they were part of these special exchanges that were based on ideological and political grounds. But that's a very rare case. And he photographed himself and these African journalists in a very remarkable way. They've never been published, these pictures. But until the changes took place in China, the opening up of China, and the realization in Africa that China was going to be a major player in the future, economically, etc. There were in the 60s and 70s, 60s in particular, some agreements between China and other countries that had adopted a more revolutionary stance. The Chinese built the Tanzam Railway and did a number of things of this nature, but it was very limited. And the interaction between China and Africa was very limited until the 90s, the late 90s, and the noughts, as we call them, right?
And so how is Guangzhou absorbing all of these new arrivals? You know, is there ethnic strife with this wave of African immigrants? What language are they all speaking? You know, I'm curious, because they're coming from countries with many different languages.
I mean, one thing is that we whenever you talk to Africans there, they all see their presence in China, in Guangzhou, as kind of the flip side of China's involvement in Africa. To some extent, they feel like they have a right to be in China because there's so much involvement in China. So I think on the one hand, there's a lot of there is a lot of racism in China. I mean, a lot of xenophobia, and, even more than Europe or America, certainly. I think China sees itself as pretty homogeneous or just, not open, particularly to some places like Africa, even though they are present in Africa. I mean, there's all these older trade routes with the Middle East, with South Asia, but I think Africa is so radically different than China that it's hard for the Chinese to kind of accept this, even though they are present all over the world now. Mm-hmm. So I think it has been a struggle for most Africans that are in China, particularly if they want to stay longer. But it's kind of changing every time I go back. In the beginning, it seemed like it was the population was growing quite quickly. Just in the last couple of years, it's actually starting to condense and to get smaller. I think in part because of the Ebola crisis.
So you mean specifically the African immigrant community?
Yeah.
Well, there's the Ebola crisis, but there's the economy. I mean, sensitive. I mean, the Chinese economy has been shrinking a little bit, and therefore the opportunities are less than they used to be. Right. But to help to answer your question, I was just a few weeks ago in Yongkang in Zhejiang province with a group of photographers. It was a sort of master class I was involved in, and I showed Daniel's pictures to the students to see, because I thought I wanted to try and explain to them that there were great things that one could do at home without having to travel around the world, and I was showing this work, and they looked at it. I didn't get that many reaction except from one pretty young guy who I thought all of a sudden was Donald Trump in person. And the way he spoke, he said, "Oh yes, but there are 200,000 of them in Guangzhou, and they're terrible people. You know, they come, they rape, they steal, they do awful things. They should all be kicked out of the country." I mean, really Donald Trump language, etc. In China, a young Chinese photographer. I was stunned.
Yeah.
And I tried to provoke a discussion around that to see how others, but nobody really wanted to get involved in the discussion. Mm-hmm. So you do know that there is something very, very sensitive there.
I mean, I found that the further away from actually interacting with the Africans, the more racist they tend to be in China. I mean, I found that, I had a video on the Chinese equivalent of YouTube, and there were all kinds of racist comments about this video actually, and they were saying all kinds of terrible things. But I find the Chinese that are actually interacting and doing business with the Africans, that they're actually very welcoming and realistic, and actually there's a lot of intermarriage too.
It's evident in some of the portraits, right?
Yeah,
as though there were some couples.
I mean, it's been going. I mean, the African presence has been there for maybe 15 years now in a major way, and so every time I go back, I see more and more interracial kids. And so, at the beginning they were infants, and now when I go back, they're maybe 10 years old. So it is happening, and it's happening in Africa too. There's kind of like this, the reverse is happening, where mostly Chinese men are marrying African women.
Mm-hmm.
For China, for a country like China, it seems quite natural that there would be this international community. Any other country in the world would have this very cosmopolitan place. So in a way, it felt. I lived in China for many years, so I never really encountered anything like that. But at the same time, when I saw it, it felt like, oh, well, China is just a normal country with a big international expat population.
Well, that gets back to what I was saying when I was reading about Guangzhou, that it has this amazing history, mercantile history.
Right.
So it has been a crossroads both of people and of goods. Mm-hmm. But does the city, is that part of its own sense of itself, its identity?
Well, I mean, I think after the communists took over, that's when things closed down. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's, you know, in the last 20 years, it started to open up. But I think it is part of its identity. I mean, you see it in the architecture. Much of the architecture is colonial. Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of in the DNA of the city. Mm-hmm. That's how it was built to some extent.
Yeah. But it's understandable also that Guangzhou would be, of all cities in China, where Africans would go to because of weather conditions. It is the south.
Sure.
It is warm.
Sure.
You don't find big communities in Beijing, or forget about Harbin, forget about Shenyang, or places up north. It is Guangzhou. Guangzhou is a big, messy city. It's cosmopolitan. There's a long tradition.
And it's fairly close to Hong Kong, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a warm city. It's the south. It's like it's Florida almost, and China, almost.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the reasons they're there is because, you know, the Pearl River Delta is where a third of all the goods in China are produced. So that's the marketplace where all these things are brought to market.
So there are other large groups of immigrants also from other parts of the world, or are Africans really the most visible immigrant group in Guangzhou?
When you go there, they're the most visible.
Yeah.
I mean, this one neighborhood, Xiaobailu, has... there's Middle Easterners, there's a lot of people from northwest China, from Xinjiang province. But they've been there for forever. I mean, there's always been these trade routes. Whereas the
Bangladeshi?
African, what's that?
Bangladeshi also?
Yeah, South Asians, some Indians. But the Africans are like the new kids on the block. Mm-hmm. They in a sense, they transformed the neighborhood and kind of defined it. So that's kind of why it seems significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the place is called Little Africa, right? Or sometimes Chocolate City?
Yeah, well, actually, the Chinese called it Chocolate City.
Which has some rather interesting, because, yes, connotation.
Well, they didn't think that was, you know, there was any problem with that. But then actually, I think Western journals started calling it Little Africa because they were so appalled by Chocolate City.